You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 25th of November 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, the world is shown a glimpse of a Germany post Angela Merkel as a coalition deal is agreed. We'll look at how three parties seemingly at odds could come together to shape the country's future. Also, are we any closer to a ceasefire in Ethiopia? The US says peace could be reached, but the president is heading to the front line to join the fight. All that plus our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay brings us the latest from his part of the world. We'll go through the newspapers and we'll look at the Grammys' focus on international music too.
Another thing that's new is the fact that there are no more nomination review committees. So everything is by direct vote from the membership online.
That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. A quick look first at what else is happening in today's news. France's government is to hold an emergency crisis meeting after more than 30 migrants drowned in the English Channel. Sweden is without a prime minister again after the newly appointed Magdalena Andersson resigned hours after being sworn in. And the Estonian prime minister has warned the EU to push ahead with sanctions on the Belarus state airline Belavia after several countries in the bloc expressed doubts over the measure. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, we now know the shape a post-Merkel Germany will take. Yesterday, a coalition deal was announced among the Social Democrats, the Greens and the Liberals. The negotiations were swift and, above all, they were private. And some of the coalition's policies are now being made known, however, with a welcome for migrants, the removal of coal and the reintroduction of compulsory COVID vaccines for certain workers. Also, David Wilp is the deputy director of the German Marshall Fund's Berlin office and joins me now. It's good to have you on the programme with us. It just seems to be so harmonious, almost too good to be true, doesn't it?
It's very true. And you mentioned the coalition talks were quite disciplined. There were no leaks over the past 2 months to journalists. Although it seemed harmonious in front of the cameras yesterday, the members of the three parties did say that it was sometimes heated when it came to talking about sticky issues, because the three parties do make for strange bedfellows, but I guess they're all trying to unite under the headline of transformation and modernization.
Indeed. I mean, if you could just briefly recap who the main players are. We have opposite ends, almost opposite ends of the political spectrum, and the way that this has been formed, we have a a very liberal finance minister, a green foreign minister, and a social democrat chancellor.
Yeah, so it is definitely a center-left coalition. I guess the odd party out are the Free Democrats, who have been Germany's traditional kingmaker party, but they are very sort of strict fiscal adherence to a debt break. So the Greens and the SPD definitely want to spend more, whereas the FDP would like to stick to fiscal austerity. So it's going to be hard for this coalition to reach its goals of climate neutrality, spending on digital infrastructure, but of course with no tax hikes. And the three players you mentioned are in fact the incoming chancellor, Olaf Scholz, the current finance minister in this caretaker government. The vice chancellor, Robert Habeck, looks like he will be in charge of a super ministry for climate and energy. And he sort of actually bypassed Annalena Baerbock, the chancellor candidate for the Greens, who is slated to be the foreign minister. Although his worth really rose during the coalition talks because the Greens didn't do so well on the campaign trail. And then, of course, Christian Lindner from the Liberals as the finance minister.
Tell us a little bit about any details that we've had about the policies that are emerging. I mentioned briefly the welcomes for migrants, removal of coal, and the introduction of compulsory COVID vaccinations. There is more flesh on those bones, isn't there?
Well, I guess the point is that the coalition is trying to be very ambitious when it comes to domestic policy, although the first order of business for this new government is going to be to get a handle on this fourth COVID wave that's going on in Germany. And so on the domestic front, they're trying to lower the voting age to 16. They want to legalize cannabis. They want to expand the right to citizenship. So those are all things that are going to be palpable after 16 years of Merkel, which have been very much an era of continuity and status quo. On the foreign policy front, I think there will be more continuity, although there are so many issues that this new German government has to deal with, whether it's the irregular migration going on from Belarus or the troop buildup on the Ukrainian border when it comes to Russia.
When it comes to the way that, you know, just briefly going back to the idea of how consensus will be drawn, when you look at the fact that we have a green foreign minister and we have this new, this sort of super ministry, don't we, with Robert Habeck, the co-leader of the Green Party, how do they square the circle with the Liberals, who are so pro-business and so much of Germany's solid income comes from manufacturing, which is not clean?
Right. I think there is a recognition that I mentioned before that Germans prefer continuity, but I think there's a recognition that if nothing changes, the country will lose its competitive advantage, and that has made Germany an economic powerhouse here in Europe. So I think this coalition is trying to usher change with the new coalition, but, you know, under sort of the aura of continuity in the mild-mannered Scholz, who sort of positioned himself as a Merkel 2.0. And yes, there is sort of a clash between the Greens and the FDP, but I do think that they see the need that Germany needs to get sort of equipped for the new digital economy, so that there is some, you know, common ground on that front. And also, Christian Lindner mentioned yesterday at the press conference that, you know, this is a different economy in a post-pandemic world. And he understands that investments will need to be made.
Indeed. I mean, but when you look at the way that the thing has been the government has been formed, we have only one from the old guard, from Merkel's era, which is Hubertus Heil from the SPD. He's going to be retaining his post as Labour minister. Why is that an important thing when we talk about continuity?
Right. Well, I mean, we don't know. I mean, his name has certainly been floated as a potential cabinet minister again. But, you know, the SPD is not really going to name its cabinet ministers until the party convention at the beginning of December in order to confirm the coalition agreement. And it's very important for Chancellor Scholz to also have gender parity in the new cabinet. So, you know, the Greens are scheduled to unveil their picks for the cabinet today. The FDP did so yesterday. So I think there's also going to be a concerted effort to make sure that there are women represented in this cabinet. And yeah, you're right. The labor ministry is very important, has a very large budget, but so does the health ministry, which at the moment nobody really wants to claim because of the health crisis that's going on with COVID in Germany right now.
The headlines in the last 12 hours have been very much, this is the end of the Merkel era, which I think many of us are struggling to come to terms with. But this is the sunset for Angela Merkel, isn't it? What are the signs that this coalition will make a clean break from her and her legacy? Because it will be she has the biggest boots imaginable to fill.
Yeah, I think everybody recognizes and appreciates Chancellor Merkel for her, you know, her work ethic, her steady leadership over the past 16 years. But they also want to change things in Germany. And I think one thing that stands out is that this government wants to be bold. The question is whether we'll have the means to be bold. For example, it's a surprise that this government is going to take a harder stance vis-a-vis China, which Merkel has always sort of navigated very carefully because of this, you know, need to also balance trade interests with security interests in Germany. And usually the trade side of the ledger wins out. So I think that this government really wants to make change. And Merkel was always about incremental change in the past 16 years, taking her time to decide before implementing anything. And I think this government is trying to be proactive moving forward.
You mentioned the issue of trade and the way that Angela Merkel took gentle, not gentle, but steady steps forward. One thing that struck me that if we have Annalena Baerbock of the Greens as the foreign minister, she will have an enormous job ahead of her, bringing Germany to the rest of the world. And we have Vladimir Putin in Russia, who always used Merkel as the conduit into Europe. And Merkel was always used, you know, always was very strong to push back against him. They always put her towards him. How will Annalena Baerbock take on the likes of Vladimir Putin, on the likes of, let's say, Nord Stream 2, which is hugely controversial at the moment?
Yes, that's a very good point. I think Nord Stream 2 is definitely the elephant in the room when it comes to German foreign policy, whether it be within Europe or also within the framework of the transatlantic relationship. Annalena Baerbock knows her stuff. She's an expert on foreign policy. But, you know, over the years, actually, the chancellery has set the tune for German foreign policy. And that's been a trend over the past 16 years under Merkel. And there is also talk of setting up a National Security Council for the German government. So there's more interagency cooperation. So although Annalena Baerbock and Robert Habeck, as in charge of energy and economics, will have sort of ministries that have an outward looking portfolio, I still do think that Chancellor Scholz and his team will have a say when it comes to foreign policy. And Nord Stream 2 continues to be the thorn in the side of this when it comes to German foreign policy, because this gas pipeline has been agreed upon and the Greens are not happy about it. But I do believe the SPD wants to push it through.
Suda David Wilp there. Thank you so much for joining us on the line from Berlin. You're listening to Monocle 24. There'll be an unexpected guest at the upcoming Washington Democracy Summit. The US President Joe Biden has invited Taiwan along. And unsurprisingly, it's not been welcomed by the Chinese. For more, I'm joined in the studio, I'm delighted to say, by David Schlesinger, an independent advisor and commentator on media journalism and China, and the former editor-in-chief of Reuters. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Very good to have you in the studio with us. Just briefly recap for us, what is the Washington Democracy Summit?
Well, I think this is the point. In politics and diplomacy, gestures and symbolism, they mean so much more than real content. So the Democracy Summit is a group of 110 participants, not countries, because Taiwan is included. But it's an odd grab bag. So it's supposed to do three things. It's supposed to counteract totalitarianism in the world. And yet, various totalitarian leaders have been invited. I'm thinking, let's not point too many fingers, but Brazil, we're talking about Philippines, strong men. It's supposed to counteract corruption in the world. And yet, there are regimes which are quite clearly filled with corruption there. It's supposed to counteract human rights abuses, and yet there are countries which have huge human rights problems there. So it's a very odd grab bag of people. It really is a symbolic attempt for Joe Biden to say, the U.S. is back, the U.S. is important, the U.S. has friends, and we care about democracy. And so, as a gesture, he's invited Taiwan along, and as a gesture, China has made its usual angry noises.
This is a huge coup for Taiwan, however, regardless of what the circumstances are, because it has for such a while been pushing itself as a resilient example of democratic success in the face of some pretty heavy pressure from Beijing.
Oh, absolutely. And Taiwan is a democracy. Taiwan is a vibrant democracy. It's a 20 million strong island that has elections, it has a raucous legislature, it puts former presidents in jail for corruption, it does all the right things. But it is also a place that is not a country. It is a place that is under great pressure from China. It is not recognized by anyone except for 15 very small nations in the world as a country. So it's a problematic issue.
So what does this do other than protect Taiwan?
Well, it helps Joe Biden.
Right.
Because we have the midterm elections in the U.S. coming up, and China is such a toxic issue in the U.S. in particular. And it's very much like in the old days where one couldn't be seen as at all soft on the Soviet Union. Now you can't be seen as at all soft on China in the United States. So this is a way for Joe Biden to say, yes, I have a summit with Xi Jinping. Yes, we still want to have relations with China. But look how I'm protecting our friends in Taiwan.
But it does offer us a more problems, though, for the United States with regards to its position towards Taiwan. I mean, we've had Joe Biden sort of like row backwards and forth on just how much protection he will offer Taipei in the event of any kind of threat from China. But what we have here is surely an absence of strategic ambiguity here when it comes to Taiwan, inviting Taiwan into the fold, treating it as a participant, but everybody else is a country. And you start to see the formation of a more solid policy in terms of how it considers, how it sees Taiwan.
Maybe I'm more cynical than you, but
right.
I see this as an easy thing for Biden to do because it's a meaningless summit that won't accomplish anything. Here's the key thing. He did not invite Taiwan's president. That would have been a huge red line for Beijing. Who's going? The digital minister, very impressive figure, but not the head of the country, and the ambassador, or the quasi-ambassador, the fake ambassador, because there are no formal relations, the fake ambassador to Washington. So, yes, they are going, but I see it as a gesture.
How much is this genuinely irritating China? Because it is a gesture, however, it is a very public one, and it involves 109 other participants.
I think you have to look at what people are saying, and people are saying exactly what they always say. China has not stepped up the rhetoric. They said their usual line about those who play with fire will get burned, but they've said that a dozen times before. They said it's a huge mistake. They said that 100 times before. They said the U.S. should remember its commitments to a one-China policy. And they've said that 10,000 times before. So it's a shadow play where everyone's going through the same lines. But I think here's the thing. Everyone, Washington, Taipei, Beijing, everyone secretly really likes the status quo. Beijing does not want to have to invade right now because the consequences would be devastating. Taiwan does not want to be invaded because the consequences would be just horrific. Washington does not want to have to go to war in the Pacific. That would not work. Everyone wants the status quo, but everyone wants to push the envelope just a bit to show how macho they are.
The envelope's being pushed in Honduras, isn't it? I mean, there's a possibility that Taiwan could lose one of its great steadfast allies. I've lost count of how many steadfast allies
15,
Taiwan has
15.
Lost in the last few years.
Oh, okay. Yes.
It's lost quite a lot.
Yes.
It still has 15. What's happening with its relationship with Honduras? Because there's an election which could change everything, isn't there?
There's an election coming up on the 28th, and the person who looks like she might win has said in the past that she would like to make relations with Beijing instead of Taiwan. However, the U.S. urged Honduras not to change its allegiances. And most recently, I think her spokesman said no decision has actually been taken. So I think this is going to be yet another of these cases where we see who has the bigger checkbook, who can make the biggest promises, and it'll all play out. Now, certainly, yes, it would be another big blow for Taiwan in the emotional sweepstakes. But quite honestly, Honduras is not a world power. And whether it formally recognizes you or not is not, and with apologies to all the Honduran listeners here, whether Honduras recognizes you or not is not the deciding factor on whether you have a great future.
David Schlesinger, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Still to come on today's program, we get the latest on the worsening conflict in Ethiopia, and we go through the morning papers too. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We We turn now to the United States and the state of Georgia, where three white men have been found guilty of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, a black man they followed and shot while he was out for a jog. A jury found Gregory McMichael, Travis McMichael and their neighbour William Bryan Jr. guilty on more than 20 charges against them for the murder last year. Monocle's correspondent in North America, Thomas Lewis, has more.
Well, it took the 12 members of the jury, 11 of whom, it's worth noting, were white, around 10 hours spread over 2 days of deliberations to come to their verdict, which was announced just a few hours ago. And that verdict has found that Greg McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and their neighbour, William Roddy Bryan, were guilty of Ahmaud Arbery's murder last February. Now, Ahmaud Arbery was jogging on his own. He was unarmed on a Sunday afternoon late last February. When the three men spotted him, they believed that he'd broken into a house that was under construction in the neighbourhood. They chased him down, they penned him in with their vehicles, and Travis McMichael shot him 3 times at relatively close range. Now, Ahmaud Arbery's killing was, of course, one of the key cases that drove the mass anti-racism protests that swept across the United States last summer. So the interest in the trial and, of course, in today's verdict has really been acute and quite intense across the country. Now, among those in the courtroom to hear today's verdict were members of Ahmaud Arbery's family, and his mother, Wanda Cooper-Jones, spoke briefly to reporters outside the courtroom after the verdict had been announced, and this is some of what she had to say.
I never thought this day would come, but God is good.
Yes, he is.
And I just want to tell everybody, thank you for those who marched, those who prayed, most of all the ones who prayed.
Yes, Lord. Yes.
Thank you, God.
Yes, Lord.
Thank you. And now Quez, which you know him as Ahmaud, I know him as Quez.
Yes.
He will now rest in peace.
Amen.
That was Wanda Cooper-Jones, Ahmaud Arbery's mother, who spoke to reporters outside the courthouse shortly after the guilty verdict had been announced. Now, what happens next? Well, we are expecting sentencing. We don't know when that will take place at this stage. We do know, however, that the crimes that the three men have been found guilty of do come with a minimum life prison term. There is also a suggestion, too, that an appeal may come. There have been some legal scholars in the state of Georgia who've been speaking to the US media today. They suggest that an appeal is likely. But the interest in this case and the way the case and the trial itself was conducted has gained so much scrutiny over these past days that the responses have come from across the political spectrum and from all tiers of the US establishment. US President Joe Biden issued a written statement. He said that while the guilty verdicts reflect our justice system doing its job, that alone is not enough. And I would like to read you a part of the statement issued by US Vice President Kamala Harris. She is, of course, a lawyer herself, and she chose to respond to the way the trial, particularly by the defense counsel, had been conducted. This is some of what she wrote in her statement a little earlier today. The defense counsel chose to set a tone that cast the attendance of ministers at the trial as intimidation and dehumanized a young black man with racist tropes. The jury arrived at its verdicts despite these tactics. And she concludes her statement by saying, Ahmaud Arbery was a son. He was a brother. He was a friend. His life had meaning. We will not forget him. We honour him best by continuing the fight for justice.
Monocle's Thomas Lewis there. You're listening to The Globalist. Nearly a year since hostilities began between Tigrayan rebels in the north of Ethiopia and government forces, are we any closer to a ceasefire? There appears to be no dip in the fighting, but is the US right, therefore, in saying that peace could be reached? Well, Dr. Laura Hammond is a professor in development studies at SOAS, the University of London. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
Just outline for us the latest state of the fighting, please.
Well, the state of the fighting is that the TPLF-led forces continue to move slowly but surely closer to Addis Ababa. They seem to be around 200 to 300 kilometers outside of the capital city at the moment. And I think the latest, the most significant developments have been the declaration by the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, that he himself and several of the leading political coalition are going to the front lines to, as they say it, lead the battle from the front.
They say they're going, and it also says that he's taking Olympians with him. And the fact that you have the Prime Minister leading the charge literally in this suggests that there is absolutely zero sign that this thing is cooling down. In fact, quite the opposite.
It would seem so, for sure. And it also harkens back to a long history of Ethiopia, that Ethiopia has, of this image of the Ethiopian emperors leading their troops into battle, which some have said is either a statement of sort of intense bravery or intense desperation. One can't really be sure.
The difficulty that we have here at the moment, among any things, is that both sides seem to be absolutely convinced of victory. Explain the situation around that, would you?
Yes, I mean, the TPLF, for reasons that one can see when you look at the map of how much territory they've taken in a short period of time, believe that they are in a position of strength. And that while they claim that their objective is not to take Addis Ababa, what they want to do is to get themselves into such a sort of position of strength and superiority over their enemy that they can increase their demands or make sure that their demands are met. And at the same time, you know, particularly from the vantage point of Addis Ababa, where it's clear that the TPLF would not be welcome were they to enter the city, the federal forces feel that they are in a strong position to be able to push back the TPLF. So each side has been claiming that the war is almost over and that they are almost on the verge of victory.
While all this is happening, there seems to be a sort of parallel story developing with the African Union doing all it can to try to find a negotiated end to the fighting. Tell us what's happening along that storyline, would you? And how it seems to be that what the African Union and the United States is saying seems to have zero resemblance to what is actually happening on the ground.
Yes, I mean, I think that those who are involved in trying to find a peaceful solution are trying to always give peace a chance to the last possible moment, it has to be said. The African Union, under former Nigerian President Obasanjo, has been involved in a lot of sort of shuttle diplomacy, trying to talk to each side, as has the U.S. I think that the U.S. is, you know, recently has issued some statements from Secretary Feltman saying that they really felt that there was still a chance, a nascent chance, as they called it, for peace to prevail. And the reason that they say that is that they say that both sides are more able and willing to discuss what might happen with a negotiated settlement. That doesn't mean at all that they're ready to sit down at the table and talk to each other. And as the U.S. has said, they don't necessarily need to be able to do that. What they need to be able to do is set out their concerns on the table so that this shuttle diplomacy could go on and eventually they might be able to sit at the table further down the line.
And indeed, carry on.
No. I just think that, it's in a sense right for those who are involved in diplomacy to always continuously give peace some kind of a chance. But as they say themselves, events on the ground are outstripping their efforts at the diplomacy table. So really time is of the essence if there is going to be a chance for peace.
And when you have this escalation in violence, which is outpacing any possibility of a negotiated treaty and truce, you also have the additional issue of the likes of Germany and France telling citizens to leave, the US and UK issuing advisories, the UN is relocating its staff. There's a sense that the rest of the world is withdrawing as fast as it can.
I think that's true. I think that, to be honest, that these countries have been influenced by recent events in Afghanistan. They do not want to organize a massive evacuation of people with passports from their own countries, both Ethiopians and non-Ethiopians, out of the country. And so they're trying now to say, while there are commercial flights available, you should get on those flights. There are seats available. Take them and go. But I know other people who are have dual passport holders and expatriates living in Addis who are staying put for the moment. So it's not just about a mass exodus from the city.
Briefly, but arguably most importantly, the humanitarian crisis is escalating as well. People horribly stuck in the middle of all this.
It is, really. Yes. I mean, we know that in the last couple of days, some convoys have been able to get through to Tigray, to the northern region where the conflict started. But we also know that the pockets of the areas of need are expanding day by day throughout Amhara region, throughout Afar region. Some of these areas are very difficult to access. And really, there needs to be a cessation of fighting so that people who need help can get it.
Dr. Laura Hammond, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. The time is just nudging 7:30 here in London. A quick look now at the headlines. France's government is to hold an emergency crisis meeting after more than 30 migrants drowned in the English Channel. It's the biggest single loss of life in the Channel since migrant data has been collected. At least 5 women and 2 children were among those who died when their boat sank. Sweden is without a prime minister again after the newly appointed Magdalena Andersson resigned hours after being sworn in. Sweden's first female prime minister stepped down after her coalition party quit the government and her budget failed to pass. And the Estonian prime minister has warned the EU to push ahead with sanctions on the Belarus state airline Belavia after several countries in the bloc expressed doubts over the measure. Kaja Kallas said backing down could weaken the EU's hand against the Belarusian president Alexander Lukashenko. He's accused of using migrants as a weapon by sending people to the borders of Poland and the Baltic states. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Let's head to Ljubljana now and hear from our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay for the latest from his part of the world. Good morning, Guy.
Hello, Emma, and morning all.
Very good to have you. So Aleksandar Vučić, the president of Serbia, is in Russia to have words with Vladimir Putin. What is expected to be said here?
Well, Mr. Vučić is saying he's going to be talking about gas, which is, of course, a crucial issue for everybody in Europe at the moment. And Russia, very much the country which holds, well, if not the keys to the pipeline, at least it can decide on what the price of the units of gas are going to be. So Mr. Vučić is saying that he's going to talk to his close personal friend Vladimir to get an excellent deal for the people of Serbia. But on the other hand, of course, what everybody else in the rest of the region will really be looking at is what these two men are going to be talking about with regards to events in the Western Balkans. So what's happening in Bosnia and Herzegovina and what's happening between Kosovo and Serbia? Because this relationship, the Serbia-Russia relationship, really is key to everything else that goes on in the region.
A difficult question to answer. Can you briefly outline where their points of differences are?
Well, it's not really so much the points of difference. It's more of a coordinating of strategy, I think. Now, it's quite opaque. We really don't know quite what is going on here. We do know that Russia is a great supporter of Republika Srpska, which is the ethnic Serb majority region of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now, there's been all sorts of shenanigans there of late with ethnic Serb leaders in Republika Srpska, threatening more or less secession, threatening to restart the ethnic Serb army, which of course is making everybody in that area very nervous. And people have been talking about the possibilities of conflict in Bosnia because of this. Now, if Republika Srpska has the backing of Russia, then it can be quite bold in its statements, if not its deeds. If Serbia is wanting to moderate what's going on, it may be coordinating with Vladimir Putin, with Moscow, to say, hang on a second, could we maybe back off here a bit? It's not quite the situation we want to have. Or alternatively, it could be saying, well, things seem to be going quite well, everything's quite stirred up in the region, and this is how we like it. It is opaque. We don't know what's going on, but this relationship is very important for stability in the region.
Let's move on to another story where stability isn't really the key here. We have the president of Croatia, who's sort of shooting from the hip with some quite astonishing comments in the last few days.
Yeah, this is Zoran Milanovic, and it's quite bizarre. Mr. Milanovic was the Social Democrat Prime Minister of Croatia between 2011 and 2015, and he was elected as president about just under 2 years ago. And since then, he seems to have undergone this massive change in character. He's been described in some quarters as a Jekyll and Hyde character, and it's very much Mr. Hyde who's been out of late. He's been talking about the coronavirus restrictions in Austria, which is just, you know, one country over, really, and comparing them to fascism. And you can imagine how well this went down with people in Vienna. They immediately summoned the Croatian ambassador to tell them that these comments were not acceptable. Mr. Milanovic, a few days late, then apologised, but said that he wasn't really sorry about what he'd said at all, because these restrictions were absolutely ludicrous and directed by Brussels idiots who were determined to drag people down into hell. And that's just his comments on the coronavirus crisis. He's been going off-piste in various different ways, having a running battle with Prime Minister Andrej Plenković in Croatia and the defence minister, and also saying very insulting things about neighbours in Bosnia.
Briefly, is there any reason why he has suddenly decided to start saying all these things all at once and offending absolutely everybody?
I'm really not quite sure, because there's no election due. It's not helping his party, and it's not helping him at all. He just comes across as somebody who's really was once a fairly respected figure, and certainly from the outside and for a lot of people on the inside, he isn't anymore.
Finally, a brief word on the Belgrade metro. Impossible to do so because it's been going on for decades, but it started, but it's not going well.
Well, it's not going well in one sense. Construction has started in one area of Belgrade, which protesters are saying is the wrong area of Belgrade to start the metro in. A, because it's not particularly well populated. B, because it's a water source, the main water source for Belgrade. And if you're going to have construction around the main water source for a city, you might have a few problems there with the quality of your drinking water.
Guy Delaney, thank you as ever for joining us on the line. You're listening to Monocle 24. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me is a journalist, Ruth Michelson, who joins us on the line from Istanbul. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Let us begin with a story which is tragically hitting the front pages of absolutely every single paper here, at least in the United Kingdom, but is going all around the world, which is this dreadful loss of life, more than 30 people drowning as they try and cross the English Channel from France to England.
That's right. So the current death toll has been revised downwards, although they're searching for bodies. So this is according to the BBC. At least 27 people have died. But the International Organization for Migration has said that this was the biggest single loss of life in the Channel since they essentially began collecting data in 2014.
So tell us a little bit about all the reactions, because I know that the French are just about to have an emergency meeting. But because you have such a terrible, striking loss of life here, and the images coming from the Channel are incredible, the image of deflated boats, like someone said, it's been described like a sort of a garden paddling pool that all these people were trying to get across. And yet the temptation always is to politicise these tragedies.
I think that's true. I mean, I think that we should also think about the fact that, you know, what is happening on the border between Poland and Belarus is happening at the same time. And that this obviously should, you know, there are some questions about how Europe polices its borders. And now, as a result, because of Brexit, how the UK is reacting to or involved in that. So we're seeing already in the coverage, certainly some divisions and some controversy between the British officials, particularly Boris Johnson, and conservatives who are saying that this, you know, this is an example of why we should crack down on migration and not allow people to travel. And maybe some on the left, for example, the London Mayor Sadiq Khan quoted in The Guardian saying that this is on the French and British authorities to work together to provide safe routes. But at the same time, we're also seeing from the French side a totally different reaction, essentially blaming British officials in some way, so also blaming human traffickers, but saying that, you know, while the UK has pledged funds and said that they would work together with the British, and that this isn't actually the case in practice. So we're seeing that reflected, for example, in some of the in the US coverage. The Washington Post has mentions that France's interior minister called the British government's spending on stopping smugglers in the Channel minimal, and complained that the British government was using France as a punch bag while failing to address its unregulated labour market.
Everybody's words seem a little bit sort of hackneyed now. When we look at Le Monde, it talks about the President of the Republic, Emmanuel Macron, saying that France will never allow the Channel to become a cemetery. But in actual fact, such comments are too late given what's happened in the last 24 hours.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. Le Monde says the same thing. But actually, in fact, it has already become a cemetery. And that's completely true, that we're seeing this. This incident is an example of something that is ongoing, and it's about whether we choose to recognize it or not. I mean, people who are, who follow migration and what's happening across Europe say that, you know, it's not about stopping people from coming. That is not possible. People want more opportunities in their life. It's about whether they're able to do so safely. And so the arguments between British and French officials, as we're seeing reflected in the contrast between the British and the French press, for example, France 24 also quoting, of course, Emmanuel Macron, because it is French state media, saying Britain needs to stop politicizing the issue for domestic gain, and Britain has to be part of the answer. This is, you know, this is something that shows that migration will continue to happen. It's about whether officials can work together to make sure it happens safely.
Let's move on to a story that's covered in the Washington Post, amongst others, which is Interpol trying to find a new president today.
Correct. The vote should be happening as we speak, as I understand it, here in Istanbul. So there has been some controversy around this, the election for the president, as opposed to the Secretary General. The president is a somewhat ceremonial position, but that has not stopped this controversy. So according to the Washington Post, this election is one that is highlighting tension between authoritarian regimes that are members of Interpol and liberal democracies over the use of police powers. And that's mostly focused on the fact that, as we're seeing in the Guardian coverage, there is a top official from the UAE who is one of the people running to be the president of Interpol. And he has been accused of involvement in police abuses and torture, because in his current job, he oversees Emirati prisons.
Indeed. I mean, there is a case study of an academic who was imprisoned in the UAE who said he's personally suffered torture and abuse under his command and showed the scars. I mean, how much does that land with the Interpol panel when they're deciding their president?
This is a fair question. I mean, this is what Matthew Hedges, that former detainee, and Ali Isa Ahmed, who is one of the other detainees who's quoted in that story, mentioned, is that, you know, they wanted to increase publicity around this in the hope that that would reach Interpol, and that some of the delegates who are voting will consider this and will consider the multiple lawsuits that they have brought against al-Raisi, Nasser al-Raisi, this Emirati official, in different jurisdictions. But there is no clear reassurance until the vote takes place as to whether the Interpol delegates have listened to this or not.
Finally, if you're a small Australian medical business, you woke up yesterday to find yourself in a bit of a mess.
Oh, well, a bit of a mess is, I think, it's a $450 million mess, according to this news. So this is a small Australian medical consulting firm going about their business in Adelaide, suddenly finding that they are being accused of setting up a $450 million hashish processing plant inside Afghanistan, which is, of course, currently under sanctions. And so they are, according to Reuters, caught up in an unexpected publicity storm, which I think is a very pragmatic way of expressing this, after an Afghan news service said that someone from this company called C-Farm had met with counter-narcotic officials at the Afghan Ministry of Interior. But the the press in Adelaide, in Australia, pointing out that this company doesn't even make products. It's a quality assurance and pharmaceutical services company. And so the head of the company said to this site called Adelaide Now, "We've had better days."
I bet they have. Ruth Michelson, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's get the latest news from the small screen with the TV critic and broadcaster Scott Bryan. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And glad to hear that Netflix is changing the way it counts its viewers to make it all simpler. Is that right?
Well, this is the thing. This is what they're trying to tell us. Because for a while, there's been some frustration about the way that they aren't transparent enough with how many people are watching some of their programs. So, for example, if you look at the very successful Squid Game, they were saying that more than 110 million people were watching that show, which is huge. But what they don't tell you is that that counts for people watching 2 minutes of just one episode. So that has made some people go, well, really, does that really account for people who drop off after one episode? What does that mean in terms of people who might not be deciding to stick with a program all the way through? And of course, it doesn't mean that you have that much to compare it to. For example, people who watch programs in the UK are measured differently in terms of how many people watch a show that day and the next day. So what they've now done instead, as a means to be a bit more transparent, is that they now reveal how many minutes people watch of a program instead. So they used it in regards to some shows that they released just the other week. But the issue is that they're saying instead how many minutes everyone collectively viewed together. So they've said that over 110 million minutes of a certain show have been watched by everybody. But then you go, hang on, that doesn't make it any easier, because you're sort of saying now, are those people who have been, you know, if you're getting the mass amount of views together and counting the minutes together and then dividing that by the number of viewers, exactly what number have you got? It becomes a very frustrating process.
It does. And none of us seem any closer to knowing how many people are actually watching telly. Let's move on to another story about subtitles, something which many believe is a preserve of the old, the elderly, the deaf, or actually very small children learning to read, because apparently it's been demonstrated as being brilliant at helping tiny people learn the connection between sounds and words. But it's not just them. There's a whole new area of people who we never thought were fans of the subtitle.
Yeah, young people are watching subtitles way more than older people. So there was a study recently by the captioning charity Stage Text, and he said that 80% of 18 to 25 year olds watch subtitles compared to a less than a quarter of those aged 56 and above. So essentially it means that for young people, they are far, far more likely to have subtitles on all the time when they're watching programs. And partially that's down to the fact that they are far more used to having the ability to multitask. I think if you're watching a TV show, you're going to be on your phone part of the time. By having words on the screen, you're able to follow a bit more than one at the same time. I think it's also the fact that the technology, it means if, for example, you're going on social media, TikTok, YouTube, it comes as standard. I think also the success and rise of dramas, not necessarily in the English language, are far more popular with people who are younger. So they're more used to be watching them all the time too. And I think it is for me just so exciting because it means that they are far more accustomed to watching shows that maybe aren't in the English language. So they can practically get into a show from anywhere now, whilst older generations might think that they have to be reading things on the screen the entire time and might not be finding it more enjoyable. Scott. But also, I think young people just are very inclusive. They want shows to essentially be accessible and be watched by as many people as possible.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. And finally on today's show, we'll talk about the sweeping changes at the Grammys. Marlon Fuentes is former head of the Grammys Global Music, set up a new category before he left, Best Global Music Performance. He spoke to Monocle's Fernanda Augusto Pacheco.
I think one of the big changes this year was that there was a new category added, which is the Best Global Performance category. This is a very, very special opportunity for track and single-driven musical movements around the world to get an opportunity to be recognized. And this really came out of a coalition of artists working in lockstep to make these proposals to the Academy. Another thing that's very new at the Academy, another thing that's new is the fact that there are no more nomination review committees. So everything is by direct vote from the membership online.
And it's amazing this new category is up because it's called Best Global Music Performance. First of all, I think we had a chat before the interview. Of course, people are listening to albums, but I think singles are kind of the way people are more listening in this kind of streaming age as well. And I'm glad about the change of name as well, because world music is not really a title that feels kind of current in a way, right?
Absolutely. You know, that was the main point of creating this single category, was to really reflect the listening trends of music around the world. You know, if you think about a pre-internet era, right? Many of us discovered international music by going to a store. And what would we find? A world music section. And whatever they had was all we could really be exposed to. And a lot of record labels had compilations. You know, many of us remember the Rough Guide to different countries. We remember the compilations from Putumayo Records, as well as, you know, some of the great artists that we discovered through record labels. Such as Shinachi, that would bring a lot of international sound to the United States. But today, especially young people are exploring music by way of playlists that are not necessarily pegged even to a genre. And not to mention the virality of music across social media, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, to really just take in music absolutely global, turn it into a global phenomenon. So this was very reflective of that. And also the fact that the former description, which was also something that we've changed, was very, I would say, representative of a period of time that there was more of this like colonial gaze, you know, saying things, for example, that music had to be 51% or more non-Western, just sounds silly today. And so this new description, this new name of the category, and this new single category really went for a new approach and a new relationship with international artists. And as a result, we're seeing incredible new additions such as WizKid, and very exciting times ahead for music communities indeed.
I mean, you mentioned WizKid, and I think that's one, a very interesting one, because before, I mean, of course, we had amazing kind of people that won the World Music Prizes, but I feel that WizKid, I mean, he's a name that is on the charts. I mean, he could be, he's like Justin Bieber, he's like, you know, The Weeknd, Billie Eilish. I mean, his songs really dominated as well the charts in the US, in Europe. So I think it's quite interesting that finally those kind of global artists, especially, I think, in Africa, especially in Nigeria, as well, I think is doing incredibly well, and they are showing their power in the charts as well, right?
Absolutely, you know, by all measures, the essence by WizKid absolutely dominated, you know, especially here in the US. And it wasn't just, you know, for Afrobeats fans, so much so that Justin Bieber approached WizKid to get on Essence for the remix, which, you know, expanded the audience even more. So, you know, you're right. We're living in a time now where the exposure to music from around the world is at an all-time high. And one of the things that was very interesting, you know, when I was making the proposal to change these descriptions and these names was the fact that even if you look at like Google search trends, year after year, the term world music was dying. It was getting lower and lower and lower. And in conversations with a lot of my colleagues who are in academia, who teach classes on ethnomusicology, they tell me that young people don't even really understand fully like this sort of world music concept. Like it doesn't register the same thing. And in many ways, that's a very positive thing because we are really making the world smaller and more people are exposed to more music from around the world than ever before. So a very positive thing. You know, WizKid is also nominated for Best Album with Made in Lagos. And that, you know, Made in Lagos is a very special record. You know, I would say it's an exquisite banquet, you know, of sound, brilliant collaborations, and just a very, very timeless vibe there. So you're going to see special appearances from Hers, Thames, Terry, Ella May, Damian Marley, you know, productions by incredible folks. And it's just a really exciting record and you know, to that effect, two nominations in both album and single category.
And Marlon, I don't know if you can comment on that as well, but even looking at all the nominations, one trend that it became clear to me is that, I mean, we see a lot of younger artists. I mean, in the past, I mean, the Grammys were considered, you know, a little bit conservative. They liked their legacy acts. But I mean, just look at Olivia Rodrigo, only 18, Lil Nas X. I think that kind of makes the award a little bit more refreshing as well, right?
I think so. You know, I think one of the major changes that we've seen at the Recording Academy is a push for new members, for younger members, for more international membership. And these are all positive things because ultimately they reflect, you know, what is happening, you know, in music today. Of course, there's always going to be controversy. There's always going to be, you know, feelings of snubs and whatnot. But I think if we look at the whole, if we look at the entire list here, you're going to find some new names. And this is, I think, a trend that we'll continue seeing.
That was Marlon Fuentes, former head of the Grammys, talking to Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. That's all we have time for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett, and our studio manager, Chris Ablakwa. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye.